From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point. With those first three trumpet notes, that crash of brass, and a dark moon rising on a huge curved cinerama screen, Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey opened 50 years ago this week. It still looks bolder and more majestic than scores of science fiction movies that came after. It was way over budget, way overdue, and it got mixed reviews. But it remains one of the greatest science fiction films ever made. This hour on Point, the making of 2001, A Space Odyssey. You can join us on air or online. Did you see it on the big screen? Do you love it? Did you get it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is writer and filmmaker Michael Benson. His new book is called Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. You can find an excerpt at our website on onpointradio.org. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Michael, an epic movie and an epic book really describing the making of it. But before we get into the making of the movie, let's talk about the movie itself. It
Sure.
is a combination of How the West Was Won and Homer's Odyssey. What was the film about?
Yeah, well, that is kind of the $6 million question, or more like $12.5 million question in 1968 dollars. Something like 70 million today. Kubrick himself resisted questions when he was asked to explain the meaning of the film. You know,
Stanley Kubrick, resisted. The film's director.
Yeah, exactly, the director Stanley Kubrick. And the genius of the film, one of many manifestations of the genius of the film, really, is that it's a kind of masterpiece of ambiguity and opacity. You bring to it your own imagination. In the same way, in a similar way to how you bring your own imagination to literature, if you know what I mean.
I think, though, Michael, first, though, for those of our listeners, few though they may be, who haven't seen the film or know the film, let's just talk about what it is really about, the plot
sure.
of the film. We start
okay.
at the dawn of man
yeah,
with
so the,
a bunch
the
of
film.
Apes mm-hmm. with a big rectangular black thing and nobody
yes.
and no dialogue. No one
well,
talks
I mean,
for 20 minutes in this film.
It's no dialogue unless you include all of the sounds made by the ape men. But yes, it starts out 4 million years before now in this in Southwest Africa, where a bunch of starving man apes are struggling to survive in desert conditions. And mysteriously, one evening, and you see a leopard attack. You see that they're struggling, you know. And then one evening, this mysterious object appears, this black monolith, accompanied by music by the Hungarian composer Ligeti, very eerie, powerful music, and they start capering around it. They've never seen anything like it. We're talking about Australopithecus africansis, you know. And then at the end of this 20-minute sequence, the lead man ape, played by Dan Richter, who I believe is going to come on a little later in the mm-hmm. program, intuits something about he's in front of a skeleton of an animal, and he picks up a heavy thigh bone and starts thinking about it, and he starts kind of waving it back and forth. And then Kubrick inserted a flashback to the monolith to make it clear that the monolith was having a kind of an effect. And then he starts smashing it down on the skeleton, the other bones of the skeleton. And essentially what we're seeing, not essentially, what we are seeing is the first weapon, the use of the first weapon. And then you quickly see the first murder of another man-ape. And, you know, history starts, in effect.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they can then – that saves the man-apes. They can then hunt – and get protein and survive. So you have this, you know, kind of the bloody birth of the human race in that scene. Then later in the film, or almost immediately thereafter, I mean, there's the
we
very
jump forward.
Famous.
We jump forward to space. You go from the bone
right.
to the spaceship.
Right. You have, you know, what is, I think, accurately referred to as the most epic and astonishing. It's not a jump cut. It's a match cut, to use technical terms in film, meaning the object being thrown into the sky by Moonwatcher, which is that weapon. It's, we see it tumbling in the sky. That shot was actually captured by Kubrick himself, something I discovered when I researched the book. And then there's a match cut to a similarly shaped spacecraft. It's actually an orbiting nuclear weapon, which is not made explicitly clear, but it doesn't have to be. It's from tool to tool. And suddenly we're in 2001, the year 2001, and we hear the opening bars of the Blue Danube. So from Ligeti to the Blue Danube. And then I could narrate the whole film for you, but let me try to compress it. So it turns out they discovered another monolith on the moon in 2001, buried under the surface, and excavated it. And so we pick up the story when a presidential science advisor is going to the moon to take a look at this object, which has been kept secret from everybody, just a small group of scientists.
It's aliens. I'm going to move you along because there's so much to get to, and we're getting calls. We move into space. They're going to Jupiter, and then we have some problems with the computer. The computer it's the first supercomputer, HAL 9000. And I want to go to this epic scene in the film that folks might remember. The astronauts are on this journey to space. Three of them are in suspended animation. Two of them are with HAL on this mission. HAL is considered the sixth member of the mission. And here, this is the point where HAL is becoming deadly to his crew. Dave Bowman, one of the astronauts, has gone to retrieve the body of his mate Frank in a space pod. And as he's outside the spaceship at the bay doors, trying to re-enter the spaceship, he keeps telling HAL to let him in, but HAL stays silent. Finally, HAL responds.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, HAL?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
And Michael, that scene, so well known. People who haven't even seen the film know that phrase, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. It sends chills down your spine even now. That's the first introduction of a supercomputer, and really the sense of the epic that Kubrick was trying to get across 50 years ago.
Yes, and many people commented even, in the first week of when people could see it, 50 years ago this week, that HAL was the most human character in the film. That's one of the intriguing aspects of the film. The human beings, the astronauts, seem like almost like semi-automated. They are component parts of their mothership, you know. And HAL is the conflicted one. Now, the reason HAL is conflicted is made more clear in Arthur Clarke's novel version, but you can get it from the film as well, which is HAL has been asked to lie to the waking crew members about the purpose of their mission because they're keeping it all secret. And HAL is, you know, has been designed and built to provide flawless objective information. And so HAL starts getting a little bit. He kills off the whole crew except for Dave Bowman. Tries to kill Dave Bowman also by not letting him in. I'm sorry, Dave. You know, this mission is too important to allow you to interfere with it. So that's very intriguing, and that's one of the reasons I think the film is relevant today. I happen to have a piece in the New York Times today about AI, contemporary AI, misuse of contemporary AI technologies in disinformation campaigns, and the link to HAL.
So relevant today, and it was such an iconic film because for many it was the first time they actually saw a computer. Jim is calling in from Rome, Georgia. Jim, you're on Point.
My father took my son, my brother and I to see the movie when it opened in its original Cinerama form, where it was on three screens in a wraparound format. I was 12 and my brother was 10, and we went down and sat on the front row of the Cinerama theater. And we were enveloped in the movie. We were in the movie. We were surrounded by the movie, and it was absolutely awe-inspiring and breathtaking. And to this day, That was the very first DVD I ever bought, the very first Blu-ray disc I ever bought. It's my favorite movie of all time. I own a home theater store, and the cinematography is so good that I use it as demo material to this day. Probably watched the movie at least 25 times.
Wow. Thanks, Jim. Jim from Rome, Georgia, talking about the breathtaking cinematography there. Really a technological advancement in its time 50 years ago. It really a template for many science fiction pictures to come. We're going to talk about that later in this hour. We've got Michael Benson with us right now. Briefly, Michael, in researching this, very briefly, you must have come across thousands of people for whom this movie was iconic.
Well, I wasn't really researching the audience so much as researching the actual production, but I'm very well aware. I mean, it was iconic for me. You know, I saw it when I was six. I have a very similar story. My mom took me to see it in 68 when I was six, and it completely blew me away. And it's been a touchstone since, ever since, you know, as a work of art that encompasses millions of years and also millions of light years. Yeah, so... I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who had a very similar experience.
We're talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey, which opened in theaters 50 years ago today, a pioneering film that paved the way for science fiction movies to come and still is for some their favorite movie of all time. Joining me from Washington is Michael Benson. We're going to talk with two members later with of Kubrick's team. We'd also like to talk to you. Have you seen the movie? What did it mean for you? Here's the moment when prehistoric humans make contact with the human monolith. I'm Jennifer Glass. This is On Point.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. We're talking about Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey, its vision of humankind's past and future, and its uneasy relationship with the supercomputer. You're hearing the Blue Danube from the film when spaceships linking up in space, forming a complicated dance. You can join the conversation as we enter the age of artificial intelligence. Does the renegade supercomputer HAL have something to tell us? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Michael Benson. He is a writer and filmmaker and the author of a new book called Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Michael, before we get to you, I want to get to some of our callers. William is calling from Milledgeville, Georgia. William?
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. I was 18 years old, stationed on a ship when the movie came out. My shipmates and I went to go see it, and I agree with Jim and everything you've said about the impression it made and what a tremendous science fiction it was and everything. But about 10, 12 years ago, at around the 40th anniversary of the movie, I was in a thrift shop and found a copy of it on VHS. Was so happy because it had so many wonderful memories. I brought it home to watch it, and I get to the space shuttle where it's Boeing is making regular trips to the moon, and you see that in the year 2001, the only position for women are going to be sexy space
attendants.
Bringing coffee to the people. In fact, the only woman with any potential in the movie was an aging German scientist lady who was on an initial board. Being struck with that 60s chauvinism just demolished the movie and its memories for me.
Thanks, William, for that. Interesting points, Michael, that William makes. it really does reflect the chauvinism there, really reflects the times. It was such a dichotomy because you have a lot of social norms, men in charge, but a lot of technological things that were way ahead of their times, like video phones.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, actually those were Russian scientists coming down from the moon, and you did have a Russian woman, PhD, you know, she's a scientist, you know, co-equal with the other, with the men. But there's no doubt that Kubrick throughout his career, he never had strong women characters. He had a problem with women characters, you know. And so it wasn't just, I don't think it was just 60s sexism. You had strong characters in 60s cinema, obviously, but it's more of a Kubrick thing. And
Kubrick himself, such a strong character and really so instrumental to this film. Your book talks about the very complicated process that he went through. It took a very long time. There wasn't really much of a script, only 40 minutes of dialogue in the film, and yet beloved to so many people and made such an impression. Let's talk to Daniel in Bar Harbor, Maine. Daniel?
Hi, Jennifer. Hi. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. I have a question or comment, and maybe Michael came across this, or maybe it's just common knowledge. I remember as a youngster watching the film and afterwards discussing HAL, the computer, and I'm curious if there's any validity to the fact that if you add a letter to each of the letters in HAL, you come up with IBM, and it might have been a foreshadowing of the impact of computers in all of our lives way back then.
Thanks, Daniel. Michael?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's one of the questions that came up periodically over the last five decades. There's no doubt that you see the IBM logo throughout the film. You see it on technology that works well. They originally they were going to have it on HAL. As HAL's character developed and became more problematic and finally became murderous, they decided, I think fittingly, to, you know, given that IBM was supporting them and giving them ideas, that they had to take IBM, the logo, off HAL, a computer that runs haywire. So they replaced it with HAL, you know, which stands for Heuristic Algorithmic. That was a suggestion from Marvin Minsky, the computer science pioneer from MIT, co-founder of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab. Asked later about this, both Kubrick and Clark strenuously denied that there was an intentional riff on IBM by displacing it by one letter. But statistically, it's highly improbable you would just get there by accident. And so I think that my conclusion, I'll leave it to you to have your own conclusion. But my conclusion is it was kind of subliminal. They jumped one letter. And so you do have a kind of a ghost image of IBM in the letters HAL.
Michael, I don't want to contradict you on this, but in my research for today, Arthur C. Clarke says it was just a coincidence in one of his. So maybe subliminal, but so interesting. I want to hold on for a moment. I want to bring in our next guest, Dan Richter, who was part of the cast. He played Moonwatcher, the leader of the tribe of ape men in the movie. He was also responsible for choreographing the Dawn of Man sequence. He joins us today from Alta, Utah. Dan, welcome.
Hi, Jennifer. Good to be here.
Hey, so before we get you on, Dan, I want to play a little bit of that scene of yours, a lot of grunting and groaning. It's right after the ape known as Moonwatcher encounters this monolith, the big rectangular black structure. He discovers he can then use a dead animal's femur as a tool, more importantly, as a weapon. And he and his clan confront another group of apes that have taken over their waterhole. And Moonwatcher kills the other group's leader with the animal bone. Dan, you really ended up, you came in, you were a mime by trade, but you ended up actually running that whole scene. Tell us how that happened.
Well, you know, the thing was is that Sir Arthur Clarke, had... The movie had pretty much all the live action had been shot, and they were simply doing special effects. And they had tried a number of times to do the opening, and it just hadn't worked. And they had backed off it because they were, you know, wrapped up in getting the main body of the film done, and they found themselves in the position where they didn't have an opening. And they were talking to each other, and they said, you know, we never talked to a mime. And Arthur had a fellow named Mike Wilson he had done some skin diving books with, and Mike knew a producer friend of mine who had, he and I had been some of the producers of a large poetry reading at the Albert Hall. And my friend Johnny told Mike Wilson, I know a mime, he's a great mime, his name is Dan Richter. So I was asked to go out and let Stanley pick my mind. And I went out there. I wasn't particularly looking for a job in movies at that point. I was sort of busy doing my own thing and teaching mime and performing. And he said, and I was sort of cocky. I was very young. I was very cocky. And I said, well, you know, you got a problem. Your problem is willing suspension of disbelief. It's an acting problem, not a moving problem. You got to grab the audience by the you-know-what, and you got to do it right away. And I think I know how to do it because my training is based in method acting as well and extending that into large movement. And I think if we created real characters who had real problems and had real energy and were threatening and whatnot, we could do it. And he said, well, you talk a good talk, but I don't know. You're some young guy who comes in here and whatnot. I said, well, give me 20 minutes, a soundstage, and a black leotard and two towels, and I'll show you. And I showed him. I just put the leotard on, and I shoved the towels in on my shoulders to make them look a little broader and whatnot. And I played a couple characters, which was the important point, that it's like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, you know, sleepy, happy, dark, you know. You want clear characters. And he liked it and hired me on the spot. And next thing I knew, a couple of days later, I went in and there was a door where I had my name on it and said, Dawn of Man. And I suddenly realized I was in charge of this whole thing.
So a couple of Snow White characters and a couple of towels. And all of a sudden, you're in charge of the opening of one of the most iconic films of all time.
Exactly. And everybody's saying, well, what are we going to do now, Dan? You know, and so we took 8 months, but we built the theme.
So, Michael, Stanley Kubrick showing himself not just to be, he was a strong man, a strong director, with had his own ideas, but a collaborator as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things that becomes very clear if you research Stanley Kubrick is he was constantly asking his collaborators. I'm sure he was asking Dan. He's asking everybody, you know, do you think this is a good idea? You know, people he trusted. I think I'm going to do it this way. What do you think about that? And he was constantly testing his own convictions or his own positions to see what other people had to say. And he was also, as in the case of Dan, you know, he was finding people who he believed could take on authority and who were creative and brilliant and gave them responsibility and let them go at it. And then, of course, he was then in the role of editor or guide, you know, director. Actually, that's the title of the job. So there was a lot of collaboration, and he took one of his aphorisms, which I learned from Tony Fruin, his assistant during that period, was never let your ego get in the way of a good idea. Or of accepting a good idea, meaning if somebody else who's far subordinate to you has an idea, you know, take it if it's a good one.
And it worked, clearly, in the case of 2001. And Dan Richter, one of those people who benefited from that collaborative spirit. Mime actor Dan Richter played Moonwatcher in the movie. He joined us from Alta, Utah. Dan, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Nick is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on point.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on. First off, I'd like to say how proud it is of me to have gone to the same high school as Dan Richter. And it's really great to hear him talk about things on today's show. But I just wanted to make the case that anyone who really loves the movie should definitely make sure to read the novel that I believe was written in tandem by Clark around the time that the screenplay was being written.
Arthur C. Clarke.
It does clear up a lot of details and confusion that people might be lost on. But it's a really fantastic companion piece regardless, and it just makes it all the better.
Great. Thank you, Nick. Nick talking about Arthur C. Clarke. He very much worked in tandem with Stanley Kubrick on this film. And Michael Benson really charts their unique relationship in his new book about the making of a masterpiece. And Michael, talk about a little bit about Arthur C. Clarke and his role in the movie.
Well, it was really a true collaboration. You know, I've compared their collaboration to Lennon and McCartney in the sense that Clark was an optimist. I got to know him, by the way, in the last decade of his life, and I spent quite a bit of time with him, days spending time with him. I spent days with him in Colombo and in Hikkaduwa in southern Sri Lanka. He was an optimist. He was a techno-utopian, technological utopian character. And Stanley Kubrick was a skeptic and has been accused of being cold. I don't really buy that. I think he had hope. It's just that he also had skepticism. Mm-hmm. And the combination of the two, I've compared it to Lennon and McCartney in the sense that, there's a famous story that McCartney came into the studio one day with this little song he'd come up with, and it was, "It's getting better all the time, it's good." And all the verses had to do with everything getting better and better. It was kind of a pop song. And then Lennon, listened, and then he added the verse, "It couldn't get much worse." And then it became the song we know today. And so that kind of combination of sensibilities can sometimes produce something that's much greater than the sum of its parts, And it did in this case. Clark was a fantastic guy, very humorous. I learned a lot from him. He was a kind of educator. He also educated, I think, Kubrick about a lot of things. Kubrick was quite a bit younger than him.
We're talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey, with Michael Benson, the writer and filmmaker and author of a new book about the making of the movie. Michael, you come across so many fascinating little facts about this. One of the ones that made me chuckle was that while they were in the 4 years of production of this film, NASA's Mariner 4 was passing Mars, and Stanley Kubrick was worried that they might find life and it might ruin the plot of his film, and he looked into taking insurance.
That's right. He went to Lloyd's of London and tried to insure himself, if they discovered intelligent life on Mars. I mean, we're talking a period in history when we didn't know. We simply didn't know. There could have been pyramids on Mars, and suddenly the whole story is blown, Of course, it would have been incredible for many other reasons. And Lloyd's of London quoted a figure that, as Clark said, was slightly astronomical, probably no pun intended. And then his conclusion was, Stanley decided to take his chances with the universe.
Well, the universe ended up being very good to him.
Yes.
Jim is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on point.
Hi, Jennifer. In the original development of the film, Hal's voice was actually female. And I was wondering why they made that change. I think it would have been even more of an effective film and would have been, more predictive of the future with things like Siri, for example.
Michael, was that about Kubrick's attitude towards women or something else?
Oh, no. I don't think so. They went through – Hal went through a multi-stage development process, much like a lot of other aspects of the film. That film was being changed during shooting. The script was changing as they were shooting. They never actually recorded a woman doing the lines of the computer, but there was a computer named Athena, mm-hmm. which is named after the goddess who helped Odysseus out of many a scrape. And so that linked to the Odyssey theme. The first AI that they were working with or considering anyway was a kind of a robot, a sort of dim-witted robot. Athena was kind of semi-intelligent. And then the computer got more and more intelligent as they went on and as they consulted with people like Marvin Minsky and so forth. So it was just an evolutionary process, I think.
And an epic process at that. Michael, stay with us. We're talking about the making of 2001, A Space Odyssey, with Michael Benson. When we return, we're going to talk to the man who led the team that created the movie's amazing, timeless special effects. We're talking about 2001. I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. That music you're hearing from the Stargate sequence of the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. We're talking about it 50 years old this week. We're trying to figure out why a movie made in the age of the Jetsons and cheesy flying saucer movies still works today. You can join the conversation. Do you think 2001 still stands the test of time, even in this age of computer graphics? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today is Michael Benson. He's the author of Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. And now I'd like to bring in another voice. Joining us from New Marlborough, Massachusetts, is Doug Trumbull. As a young man with a yen for drawing moonscapes and spaceships, he joined Kubrick's team and became its visual effects supervisor. He would later lead the special effects on movies like Close Encounters, Blade Runner, and Star Trek the Movie. And he was director on Silent Running and Brainstorm. Doug, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, Doug. Hey, before I get to you, Doug and Michael, I want to go back to the film. So iconic. Let's go back to that moment on the spaceship, concerned that Hal might be making mistakes. The space agency runs tests with a duplicate computer back on Earth. But a crew member, Dave, is beginning to suspect that Hal is actually manipulating data and lying to the crew. And Hal knows it. Here they are moving around each other cautiously, almost like a chess game.
I hope the two of you are not concerned about this.
No, I'm not, Al.
Are you quite sure?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question, though.
Of course.
How would you account for this discrepancy between you and the Twin 9000?
Well, I don't think there is any question about it. It can only be attributable to human error. This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
The iconic voice of Hal there, voiced by actor Douglas Rain, and of course Hal lying there when we had been told that he couldn't make any mistakes, real foreshadowing of the dire things to come in that film, an iconic film. Doug, tell us about your experience on the film. How did a young guy end up being the head of visual effects on 2001?
Well, first of all, I wasn't the head. There were four of us, Con Pederson, Wally Beavers, Tom Howard, and myself. I started out as a very young animator, and my first job with Kubrick was to do the HAL readouts. And that led to solving a lot of problems for Stanley, and he started trusting me and kind of increasing my level of responsibility. So during the period that I was on the movie for 2.5 years, I moved from a lowly animator to one of the heads of the visual effects department. And so my responsibility was animation, miniatures, moonscapes, planets, stars, Jupiter, the Stargate itself. And I was solving a lot of problems because my father was an engineer, my mother was an artist, and I kind of got the genetic code of both, which comes in really, really handy for visual effects.
And it really was way ahead of its time with video phones. And you don't have the computer. You didn't have the computer generated options that you had today. I was watching a film. You made a pen fly in space. How did you do that?
Well, that wasn't my responsibility. That was Wally Beavers. And that was a pen very gently glued to a giant sheet of glass that was rotating in front of the camera. So there were no wires or anything, and she just reaches forward to the pen, plucks it off the glass, and puts it in his pocket. It's extremely simple.
And today you would just do it on a computer screen, very different than cutting it on film, and
right.
A lot more laborious on film.
Well, computer graphics are amazing what we can do today. I tend to be cautious about them because I look back on 2001 and the miniatures that we built for that movie, and I still think it looks great, whereas some computer graphics from even 5 or 10 years ago don't look great.
Yeah.
And so miniatures and what I call organic effects age a little more gracefully. And I think that 2001 still looks great today because if you do a really great miniature, it's indistinguishable from a real thing.
Well, a lot of our listeners agree with you. We're getting a lot of calls, a lot of comments online. From our website, Longerview says, believe it or not, 2001 was the only movie I ever walked out on. I thought it was great, but my sophisticated date hated it, made me walk out. Needless to say, we didn't make it to the next date. I've seen it in its entirety about 10 times since then.
Great.
And Jerry is calling from Kent, Ohio.
Hi, Jennifer. I saw it in the original 70mm. Three elderly women were behind me knitting during the opening. 20 minutes later, they looked at each other and says, I don't know what's going on. Let's leave. And they got up and left. The other thing is, that first night, they had a sheet of paper they gave to us that said that they were going to dispute the fact that NASA could put a man into space without a helmet for 30 seconds and survive. And there was this little debate in the sheet, and I never heard anyone talk about that since. But anyway, I took my students, 300 at a time, to see this film for 10 years, so many of them have seen this film and love it.
Thanks, Jerry. Michael, do you know what sheet he's talking about?
Well, no, I've never heard that. In fact, I would ask where that sheet was. Where did he see the film?
I saw it in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio.
Oh.
And they gave us the sheet as we walked in. It was the 70mm first edition.
Do we think it was the 1960s equivalent of Do Not Try This at Home?
Yeah.
I think it was the 1960s edition of a local theater manager who was skeptical
right.
of the movie.
Well, you know, let me say something, if I may, about that. So Clark and Kubrick were absolute sticklers for accuracy, and I have at least a half dozen letters between them, or cables. This is before email, of course. You know, telexes and cables, debating whether or not it's possible for an astronaut to survive a short-term exposure to the hard vacuum of space. And they were consulting Air Force doctors who had done tests on animals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the conclusion was, yes, it is possible. And if you look at the film, it was actually quite short exposure because Dave Bowman triggers the explosive bolts on the space pod, and he's basically shot like a cannon into the emergency airlock. And it's only about 40 seconds or even less, 20 seconds, where he's in hard vacuum, and then he hits the button, and then the air comes flooding in, and he survives. So that is definitely survivable. You might have bloodshot eyes later.
Or blown out eardrums.
Well, definitely all that. I mean, I'm sure you probably need some medical care after that.
And Arthur C. Clarke's only complaint about that scene was that he shouldn't have held his breath. He said that
right.
was not realistic.
That's correct.
Right. But can you imagine not holding your breath if you have to do something like that?
Let's go to Andrew from Windsor, Ontario. Andrew?
Yeah. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi there. Hi. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you. I have a story to tell. I'll tell it briefly, but I might have been one of the youngest viewers of the film. I was not yet three when it opened. And my parents, my dad was a researcher, my mother's a PhD, and my sister, who's older than me, was very much into science. So I was taken to this at 2.5. And the scene where the astronauts are on the moon and they're excavating the monolith for the first time, and there's these spooky voices,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure the author on your panel will know the scene I'm talking about, completely freaked me out. And I, like I said, I was only 2.5, and I cowered under the seat. It's my first memory, period. But you'll be happy to know that I went on to finish the film. It's become, since then, I've probably seen it 50 times, pretty much once a year. And it is by far my favorite film, by far.
Terrific.
It is. It's about everything you could possibly think of, and it remains, yeah. I think, so relevant today with AI and, you know, the future of technology and all these questions.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Andrew. So many, he's right, so many themes echo today. Artificial intelligence, HAL, the computer, taking on human characteristics for his own survival. Let's go to Bob, who also thinks this is relevant. He's calling from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida.
Hi, Jennifer. I first saw 2001 as a lad in Scottsdale, Arizona, one of the early Cinerama theaters, which was really fantastic. But in Florida, I was teaching middle school social studies in West Palm Beach. And I took the liberty, like I would go around different sections of the country, but in the beginning of the school year, I would show that movie. and I would break it up in parts from one class session to another. And we had come to that part on 9/11/2001 when they were approaching the second monolith. We'd already gone past the first one, and so the humans were now encountering the first monolith. And over the speaker in my second hour came the announcement about 9/11, which sent shockwaves through everybody and so forth.
Wow.
And it was very strange that we were on the second tower. If you think about, you know, the monolithic aspect of the Twin Towers, and having done that, and at that very single moment when I was watching it for that time in that class period, and it occurred, it was you know, mind-boggling, you know, the whole coincidental aspect of it. So, you know,
Bob,
I just wanted to share that with you.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, Bob, so, you know, this is a film that for so many people means so many different things. I know that people came out of it. Michael, I think you say in the book you came out of that the first time seeing it, asking your mother, what did it mean?
Yeah, I did. But I had no doubt that I had experienced something extremely profound. So it wasn't that kind of what did it mean in frustration. It wasn't a what did it mean in anger or irritation. It was a what did it mean that was incredibly awesome, you know, almost like a religious experience. Of course, I was age six. When you're 6 years old, you know, your receptors are wide open. When you're 3 years old, they're obviously so wide open that you hide under the seat when Ligeti comes on. Which is quite an interesting story. I asked, what does it mean? And then I've subsequently made peace with the fact that it means many things to many people, and it should. You know, that's what a great work of art can do. Kubrick actually, when he was asked what it meant by Playboy magazine in the Playboy interview in 68, he said, well, what would we think if Leonardo had written on the back of Mona Lisa, the canvas, you know, on the back of the canvas, the lady is smiling because she's hiding a secret from her lover. I don't want that to happen to 2001. So he refused to supply meanings he wanted the viewer to.
Thanks, Michael. Michael Benson with insights on 2001, A Space Odyssey. Stanley Kubrick famously hated interviews, so there's not a lot of tape out there of him talking about his movie making. But here is a little clip of him accepting the Directors Guild of America's D.W. Griffith Award in 1998 and describing what it's like to make a film.
Anyone who has ever been privileged to direct a film also knows that although it can be like trying to write War and Peace in a bumper car in an amusement park, when you finally get it right, there are not many joys in life that can equal the feeling.
Stanley Kubrick there. And of course, the making of 2001, the conception of 2001 was broad and ambitious on so many levels. Doug, did you know what he wanted when you got there? Did he know what he wanted?
Yes. I mean, I had a really interesting meeting with him. I was a very young guy, maybe at the in the second year of production. He had this baby doll in his office, and he said, what do you think if Bowman comes back as a star child? And I took me about 2 seconds to say, yeah, I think that'll work. And it did.
Wow.
And it's the fundamental kind of impressionistic version of human transformation.
The star child, of course, the end of the movie when Bowman becomes this kind of baby in a bubble in space, leaving open to your imagination the transformation. And that ending, Michael, wasn't apparent.
What do you mean it wasn't apparent?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, during the making of the movie, Arthur C. Clarke talks about rewriting the ending 100 times, and they weren't sure how it was going to end. At first, they thought it might have ended where it began with the finding of the monolith.
Yeah, they actually had an ending where a very elongated kind of skinny alien takes a human astronaut by the hand and they walk into infinite darkness.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, well, so I think that was actually cannibalized or adapted a little bit later by Spielberg. But that was that's just not the way that film should have ended, and they understood that. And so they worked it over, and then Clark came up with this ending one day, and they were constantly phoning each other. This is when they were both in London. A lot of the time, Clark was in Ceylon, now
Sri Lanka. Yeah.
Yes. So he phoned in alternate endings to Stanley, and Stanley really loved the one. He got excited by this one of the rebirth at the end. And I make the point in my book that it's a kind of a realization of a very profound statement by the Russian rocket pioneer and visionary futurist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who at the turn of the 20th century came out with this epic statement, Earth is the cradle of the mind, but humanity cannot remain in its cradle forever. And I know that that statement, it was kind of almost like the marching orders for the space age, but it certainly was influential for Clark and later for Kubrick. So I think it was kind of an externalization or realization of that that statement.
Hey, Doug, I want to get to you very briefly. We're running out of time, but could a movie like this be made today, so taking so long, so much budget, so much uncertainty, not even a full script?
Absolutely, yes.
Really?
Yes, but it takes studio management with the vision to trust the director to do the right thing. Because you're talking about an art form that's very visual, very musical, very experiential, and very immersive, and that's not based on the ordinary conventions of drama and plot and structure and character development and character arc and conflict. 2001 is quite a unique movie. It's never been replicated anything close in the 50 years that has gone by. And I kind of take it as my mission as a director who's still alive and kicking to try to do something like that again.
Thanks, Doug. That's Doug Trumbull, who was a visual effects supervisor, and Michael Benson, a filmmaker and author of Space Odyssey. You can continue the conversation at On Point. We've been talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. I'm Jennifer Glass, On Point.